Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9. We're here in the green room, the waiting area of our wonderful Channel 9 studios, and I've got a special guest with us. Tell us who you are and what you do, my friend.
Morning, Seth. My name is Val Fontama. I'm a principal data scientist in the Azure team.
You're like my peoples, man. I love data science. Tell us a little bit about what you do in that team.
Sure. So I lead a team of data scientists that build ML models. So every day we build machine learning models to solve different problems for either the products or the business. So for instance, we build a model, for instance, you can use to target who's the best customer for Azure.
Okay.
Right? Marketers love that.
Yeah.
Another one could be a model that predicts, for instance, which customer is likely to churn out of Azure, right? That's a bad thing because we love our customers and we want you guys to keep using Azure.
So we're using a lot of insight and data that we have to help understand our customers
Absolutely.
And to delight them. So Absolutely. What are we going to talk about today?
Today I want to share an experiment that I have in our Azure ML gallery. I have about three or four experiments, but the one I want to share specifically is one that does predictive maintenance.
I see. So before we talk about that, tell us about what the gallery is and when you say you've got a lot of experiments in the gallery, what does that mean?
Yes. Now, the gallery is a really cool feature of Azure Machine Learning because what it is, it's basically a collection of solutions and templates that other data scientists have built for the community. This is really cool because it's a very good way to share knowledge, to share learning and IP with the data science community. It has many, many different types of solutions for different types of problems.
I see.
Right? The one I have today is on predictive maintenance, but they have other models you can use for targeting customers, for instance, which is great for marketing. There are other models in there you can use for clustering your customers. There are other models for doing anomaly detection. So many different Azure ML models and data science models that target different scenarios. The great thing is it's a very good accelerator for someone who's new to Azure Machine Learning or, for that matter, someone who's new to data science.
I love the word accelerator you use because for me, like the first thing as a programmer, as a data scientist, we have this sort of blank page syndrome where we freeze up. You're saying that the experiments in the gallery are a good way to say, I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm doing something like that. Let me see what's in there and then start with that.
Absolutely. And honestly, Seth, this is not marketing. It's a real time saver, right? Because if you have a new project with very, very limited time, what are your options? Option one is you basically lose sleep.
And struggle.
you work 20-hour days for a week or two, which is not sustainable because, you know, at some point you stop thinking straight. Option two, which I highly encourage, is to use the Azure Machine Learning Gallery because with a very quick search, I bet you've come up with many different solutions and templates, experiments that other data scientists have created for your benefit, right? I'm not saying copy and paste, you can't, because you have to build a customized solution for your particular application. But it's a great start, because as we'll see in a minute, each of those experiments or templates will show you how someone else approached that problem, right? It gives you the outline of the solution. And with that, you can basically kickstart the project because you save yourself at least a week, right?
That's amazing. So now that you've sold this so much, let's take a look at your particular template, what it's solving, and someone out there might be thinking, oh, my problem is just like that, let me look at this template. So let's dive in.
Sure, Seth, so it starts in the gallery. So when you log into Azure ML Gallery, this is what you see. In fact, you'll see many more, but what we're looking at here is the results of a quick search I just did for predictive maintenance, right? I just searched for predictive maintenance and it came up with 409 different results.
Wow.
These are different experiments and solution templates and collections that other data scientists have built. You can just browse. It gives you a huge opportunity to learn before you start your own project.
So is this specific to like aerospace or machinery? Could this be for anything? What is this for?
That's a great question, Seth, because predictive maintenance is very, very broad. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, it applies to many areas of manufacturing.
Of course.
It is highly related, by the way, to this new wave around the Internet of Things, mm-hmm. right? Because if you think about it, when we talk about IoT or Internet of Things, it's not enough to just collect all of this data from machines and store it safely,
yeah.
right? That's a waste of time
and money. It's a waste of bits too. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. The real value is in what you do with that data. If you can use that data to learn new things about your machines, mm-hmm. but those machines can be any type of machines.
Yeah.
It can be cars, it can be washing machines, it can be ATMs, anything. And the reason predictive maintenance is so important, especially to manufacturers, is that it will reduce their operational costs significantly. Because today, it costs a typical manufacturer literally billions of dollars, right, to maintain their machines. If you build ATMs, for instance, that you supply all over the world, you have to manage a large fleet of support engineers who will go out and monitor those things on a regular basis.
Right.
But typically, the machines don't warn you before failing, right?
No.
Even with a good regular maintenance cadence, the machine can break any time in between. And today, you waste a lot of time and money. And in some cases, if you don't respond quickly enough, you can lose customer satisfaction, right? When you have unplanned downtime.
Right.
So predictive maintenance really gives them a very good tool to streamline their maintenance processes and reduce cost. Because with predictive maintenance, what happens is you collect data every few minutes or every hour from your machines, you run it through an ML model mm-hmm. that will predict yes or no, will this machine fail in the next day or two, right? And if the answer is yes, then you trigger an alert to actually send someone to fix it before it actually breaks down.
And that's amazing because as a customer, right, mm-hmm. we only remember when things are broken.
Yes.
And even if I've had 10 years of great experience, that one experience where it's broken is going to make me fly off the handle. Maybe not me, but other people, right? And so you're saying that these kinds of models help you be able to delight customers before you upset them.
Absolutely, because if you do it right and if you use the right predictive models, you can actually prevent customer dissatisfaction significantly, right? Because you will deal with the problem even before it happens.
Yeah,
right.
And so that's amazing.
In the case of an ATM machine, you can fix it before it breaks down. I don't know if you've ever dealt with a broken ATM machine.
That's a scary prospect.
It happened to me once, and it was at the wrong possible time.
Oh no!
I was in a hurry to drop off my kid, and when I put in my card, the machine sucked it up, and I realized it was broken.
Ooh.
And basically, I lost about an hour, you know, dealing with the bank to have it resolved. So
goodness.
Not a good experience.
Not a good experience. All right. Well, let's see how the computers can help us.
Okay. So in this case, when you do the search for predictive maintenance, as I said, you get many different results. These are experiments that data scientists have built for different manufacturing problems. Mm-hmm. So for instance, you see one for aerospace, right? This one was built specifically with data from the aerospace industry. I think there's more than one there for aerospace. There's another one here to predict failure on an aircraft engine, which can be absolutely critical
right.
to aircraft manufacturers and airlines.
Sure.
This one is mine. So if you click on it, it gives you a summary of the experiment. And this is what you get with all of the experiments. When you click on it, you'll get to a summary, which tells you, you know, a little bit about the experiment. What does it do? Why is it important? Which algorithms does it use?
Sure.
Then what?
Right? It's like, this is nice, right? Yes. But
so if it's, if the problem is not close to yours, then move on. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just browsing, go back and check another one. Mm-hmm. Maybe the aerospace one is better for you, right?
Right.
If that's the problem you're trying to solve. But if this is what you're looking for, then your experiment starts now, right? You click on open, it will go ahead and open that experiment in the gallery for you.
And so, like, those that haven't seen the Azure ML Studio,
yes.
Usually you have to go in there and you have to start making all these things. You're saying that if you click it in the gallery, it's just going to make it for you.
Absolutely. Okay. And I'm glad you called that out, Seth, because if you start from scratch with Azure ML, I mean, and this is common with any machine learning tool. You know, you start with a blank sheet. So you have to decide what you need at every stage, right?
Sure.
Where do I even start? Okay, let's start with the data. Mm-hmm. But you have to do all the work to build out your full experiment. Here, with one click, it takes me into the Azure ML Studio. Mm-hmm. So the only thing it's asking me is, number one, what region do I want to deploy in? I'll go with South Central US. I have many different workspaces. Which one do you want to use? Mm-hmm. If I click on that, it'll just go ahead and open the experiment for me.
And so right now, it's taking the template that you made,
yep.
and it's just importing it. So this, if this was me, it would be putting it into my workspace.
Absolutely.
To actually see exactly what you're doing.
Absolutely.
So as this is loading up, because it might take a little bit of time, maybe not as much, but let's talk about your scenario in particular. Will you set the stage for what kind of predictive maintenance we're doing?
Yes.
Because there's a really good video that I did with one of our data scientists in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where he talks about the sort of the seven steps of machine learning.
Yes.
And he says it always starts with a question, and
yes.
then the data, and then we go from there. So what's the question that you're asking in this particular model?
And that's a great question. So it always starts with the business problem.
Yeah.
You know, I teach a data science course at the University of Washington, mm-hmm. and this is one thing I always emphasize with my students. You have to be very clear what problem you're solving mm-hmm. before you start building any machine learning model. Otherwise, you could spend weeks building an elegant solution for the wrong problem. So the problem at hand is from the semiconductor industry.
Okay.
So typically they have they can have high yield failures if you don't manage your manufacturing process closely, because it's a very, very complex process to go from raw sand
yeah.
to the actual silicon
yeah.
chips,
yeah.
right? And typically, with very few exceptions, semiconductor manufacturers tend to be very specialized in one or more steps of the process.
Sure.
So you go through several manufacturers to actually integrate everything into the final chips,
right?
And so one of the key things they want or they care about is reducing yield failures. How do we reduce the yield failures at the end of the line when
you
finally put everything together on the chip, right?
Because it's better to catch it early where it's cheaper.
Absolutely. Because by the end of the process, it's already too late.
Sure.
Right? If you're getting very high failures at the end of the process, it's costing you too much money and time. Mm-hmm. So if you can catch it upstream earlier, everyone's happy. So for this particular problem, it starts with the business problem that I've outlined. Next thing is, what's the data?
Mm-hmm.
In the real world, you would get the data from the manufacturer themselves. But since we don't have that luxury,
mm-hmm.
in this case, I used synthetic data from UC Irvine.
Oh yeah, which has tons of really cool data sets.
Yes, UC Irvine is they have a great database of really good data sets for different types of problems.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very good resource for teaching and learning machine learning.
And this is the data right here.
So that's the data. It basically has 1,576 rows
mm-hmm.
and 592 columns. So what are these columns? One of the columns is the actual output, which is, for this particular batch, did it pass or fail?
I see.
Right? So it's a binary variable, 0 or 1. Then the remaining 591, they're just readings from different sensors along the chain, right?
Okay.
As you go from raw sand all the way to the final IC chips, they have the sensors at different steps collecting data every single second, right? Mm-hmm. So they collect all of that data, and this is what we're seeing here. So the raw, the actual data itself came from a real manufacturer, mm-hmm. but to protect their intellectual property, they renamed all of these input fields. So that's why the names here are just sensor number one, sensor number two, etc.
And thankfully, with machine learning, it doesn't care what the feature name is, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Just give me the data.
Yeah.
So that's what the data looks like. And typically, this is where you start with your experiment. Once you define the business problem, you will get the right data set, because that's what the algorithms will learn from. Mm-hmm. And then we can eyeball the data. I'm just looking at the distributions now. We need to see what do the distributions look like. Some of them are good. You see, this one looks like a normal distribution.
Yeah.
So does sensor number two. But there are others there that are highly skewed, right? This one has a big lump here and nothing else. Sensor number six is not very good in that it only has one unique value.
And so it's not very discriminative, yeah.
Yes, everything has 100, right? So no, we will drop this.
So as a data scientist, this is a question I've always had, and this is kind of maybe tangential.
Yes.
When you're looking at this, because there's this step now where you have to look at your data, see what it's doing, get some pictures. Because maybe you get this picture and you know, wow, it looks like this column sensor 5 always predicts the outcome, so we're done. Mm-hmm. How do you know which features are the ones that will be discriminative of the actual class that you want to predict?
That's a great question.
Is this like voodoo magic?
You know? It's not. It's just science.
Yeah, I love it. but
it's a great question. Because out of the 591 input sensor readings, mm-hmm. we won't use all of them. Because as you're starting to see, not all of them are useful. You know, if you see a variable like sensor number 6 that has only a single value for all records, will drop it.
Right.
It has no variance, so it cannot explain the yield failure. It can't explain the output.
I love the way you use that. This column cannot explain the answer that you want.
Yeah.
So you have this specific question. You look at the column and say, "It looks like this is not going to explain it."
Yes. Yeah, so some of it is just brain dead obvious, like this one.
Yeah.
If you see any variable that has the same value for every single record, drop it.
Yeah.
Then other things we'll do, and I'll show you in the rest of the experiment, is we have to deal with missing values,
mm-hmm.
because sometimes you have too many missing fields in the data. What do you do with it? You can treat it or eliminate that particular variable. And then there are other things you can do to find which features are important. For example, we can do simple correlation analysis to see which input variables are highly correlated with the output variable, right? That's very simple, but I'll show you a more sophisticated tool we have out of the box in Azure ML for feature selection.
Okay.
And I'll show you how we actually use it to reduce the number of columns from 591
mm-hmm.
down to only 50.
Which is
even less.
Which is much better, because my spidey sense, and you tell me if I'm wrong, is the number of rows and the number of columns. If you have a large percentage, like let's just say if you were to divide columns by rows and that percentage is high, that there's going to be a problem. Is that true or not?
Yes, you're getting at something very important, Seth. So typically it's harder for the algorithm, no matter how powerful it is, it's harder for it to learn when you have too many variables. Like in this case, we have 591 input variables, mm-hmm. right? So the number one, you want to reduce the number of variables to the bare minimum, right? Because it makes it easier. When you have too many variables, we run into the curse of dimensionality.
Of course.
Then the second thing, which is very important, and you alluded to it, is how many rows do we need? How many examples do we need in the data set, right? There are rough heuristics, but the bottom line is, if you have too many variables, then you will have exponentially more, you will need exponentially more rows.
Pack learning, friends.
Yes. Otherwise, you know, like in this case, I'll be very honest with you. It's very hard for any machine learning algorithm to learn effectively from only 1,576 examples when you have 591 columns.
Yeah.
It's tough. You just don't have enough data to play with.
And there was a class I took on this thing called pack learning, which is probably approximately correct, and it tells you roughly how many rows you need to be correct with this percentage, with this probability percentage, which is really mind-boggling to me that we could do that. And so that's why I looked at this. I'm like, wow, a lot of columns, not a lot of rows. There might be problems.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it's not just machine learning. You have the same thing in statistics as well.
Right.
So in statistics, we actually have formulas you can use to tell you how many rows you need in your sample if you want your error within, say, the 95% with 95% confidence interval, you will need a sample size of n, right?
Okay.
Similar thing applies to machine learning.
Fantastic. All right, let's dive in some more. Sorry for a little digression.
Nope, that's perfectly okay. So let me get out of this, and then I'll just show you a few other steps. So in this step, what I'm doing is I'm selecting which variables will be used in the modeling, right? And for this very simple example, I only eliminate one, which is a timestamp. So if we click on that one, you see what it does. So here you can tell it to either include or exclude certain columns. And I just exclude one, which is timestamp, because timestamp is not really useful for this modeling process.
It's literally just a straight line that's not going to tell you anything.
No. But it's worth adding that for certain types of problems, you know, like if you are dealing with time series data, then that timestamp is very important.
Gotcha.
Yes. Next is this missing value scrubber. I said, you know, in many cases in the real world, your data is never clean.
No, because Jim tripped over the plug to the sensor and they're like, oh, I better plug that in, and you missed an hour of time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right? There could be defects on a particular sensor at any time. It doesn't tell you, right? It could take time before we find out.
Sure.
So for various reasons, you'll have problems with the data. And one of them is missing data. Luckily, Azure Machine Learning has this tool called Missing Value Scrubber. And if we check, one thing I should have mentioned earlier is, whenever you click on any module, look on the right panel, and it shows you the properties of that module.
Gotcha.
Right? That's where you can go in and see exactly what the module does, what parameters it's using, and that's where you can change the parameters as well. So if I click on Missing Value Scrubber, it tells you a number of things here. So one, what do you want to do with missing values? What should I do, right? By default, it says, hey, do a custom substitution value. That means, if there's a missing cell, add this value, replace it with this value. Okay, what value should I replace it with? By default, it just replaces with zero. But you could replace with a different number. You could say -1 if you want. Totally up to you.
Is there a way to like replace it with the average, for example, just so it doesn't?
Yes, you can. So.
There you go.
I'm glad you asked. Very good question, Sid, because there are other options, right? You can replace it with the mean of that column. You can replace it with the median.
Which are very different things.
They're very different. Yes, it could be different.
Yeah. Sometimes they're the same and sometimes, it just depends on.
Yes, you could replace it with the mode, right? The most frequent value. Or, heck, you could just drop that entire row. Right?
And so that's interesting.
Gives you all of these options.
Because you really don't know which one's going to be better, so you should probably try a number of different iterations. Is that the case? Or do you have a sense of, I should just do this every time?
I think you have to experiment, because it starts with investigating the cause of the missing value.
Of course.
Right? Is it just erroneous? or is it something more systemic? Because as in many cases, missing value doesn't tell you anything. But there are cases where the missing value itself carries information, right?
Oh, that's an interesting way to look at it.
Let's say we're looking at a credit card application, for instance, and for business reason, the credit card issuer decided to exclude a specific zip code, right? It's illegal, by the way.
Yeah.
But if they did that, then you would infer information from that missing value. Each time I see a missing zip code, oh, that means this applicant is in an excluded zip code.
And it might also be the case that you'd be able to create a new feature based upon that, where it's like, this excluded, yes, no, and then you've created a new column based upon a different column.
Absolutely. That's why, you know, how you deal with missing values, how you deal with outliers, needs good thinking and thorough investigation.
Science, effectively.
Yes, you shouldn't just apply a simple blanket rule like, I just replace everything with zero. You have to first of all understand the cause of the missing values, right? Is it just defects? Is it just data quality issues? Or is it more systemic?
Who would have thought that machine intelligence required a lot of pre-human intelligence first, right?
Uh-huh. That's why you do need humans. You do need a good data scientist to use these algorithms effectively
right.
in the first place.
All right, okay. Let's keep going.
So you asked a very good question earlier, Seth, about, you know, which features do we need? Which features do we keep or drop, right? And how do we know?
Yeah.
How do I know which ones to keep or drop? I mentioned a number of easy things you can do, like eliminating any fields with the same value. They don't carry any information. Mm-hmm. I mentioned doing just basic correlation analysis. That can help because it tells you if there's a strong correlation between a single input value and the output. But it's not very sophisticated because even if a variable on its own is highly correlated with the output, it could behave differently when you add many other variables.
And there could be leakage, right? too, from the output into the input.
There could be that. So typically, we shouldn't end with just simple correlation.
Okay.
Simple correlation tells you which features are promising, but it's not the end. You really have to do more sophisticated feature engineering to find the most important input variables
right.
to use. So Azure ML actually offers a very good feature called, there's this module called filter-based feature selection, right? What it does is it uses different algorithms to find the most important variables. So let's see how it works. If I click on it, look at the property pane, the first thing it asks me is, Val, how many features do you want to keep? That's the number of desired features. I say 60, right? 60 out of 591.
Which is
a huge reduction.
Yeah.
I could even say 50. Heck, why not?
Yep.
Right? It's totally up to me. Then the other thing you define is, what's your target, right?
Because
when it does when it chooses which features to keep, it has to do it based on a certain target.
Got it.
In this case, the target is my business goal, which is captured in the yield column, right?
Got it.
That's the output. Then we have seven different ways you can use to do that feature selection.
Wow.
Right? You can use correlation, and there are three different types of correlation from Pearson, Kendall, and Spearman. You can use mutual information, etc. I tend to use mutual information because I find the correlation ones are too simplistic.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Anyway, so this one does feature selection, and then I go into splits. Why am I splitting the data? We split the data because typically, if you only use all of that data for training the model, you run the risk of overfitting,
mm-hmm.
which means the ML algorithm will learn all that it can about the training data. It will perform very well on the training data, but poorly on test data. So when you deploy it in the real world, it wouldn't work very well.
So it won't generalize really well because you literally gave it everything you had, and now it's going to know just that.
Yes. So to avoid that, the simplest technique we use is to split your data. You can split it two ways or three ways. So at the very minimum, you split two ways. You use one sample for training, and then a holdout sample for testing.
So in your experience, what's the split? I usually tend to do 80 on the training, 20 on the test. Is that a good rule of
thumb? It's reasonable. 80-20 works, 70-20 works. Typically, you want to use more of your data for training, right? Because the more data, the better. But you really want to have a large enough sample for testing.
Got it.
And in cases where you're really strapped, you can, instead of doing the two-way or three-way split, you simply use cross-validation.
Right.
Through cross-validation, you basically take your small data set and you split it. Say, if you want to do five-fold cross-validation, you split the data set into five, not three.
Yeah.
And then the algorithm will rotate out one of those samples for training and testing. So I start with four of those samples for training and test with one. Then next time I swap one out and use the remaining four for training.
Got it.
And the new one, the holdout one for testing. That tends to be more robust.
And then and then you just pick the model that does the best on the testing after you've done the cross-validation?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay, so after that we go into training. So here, or if I just show you, here I split the data into two.
Yes, 70-30. Yeah.
So 0.7 there means the right branch will get 70% of the data. Mm-hmm. Then the remaining 30% will go into output node 2.
Got it.
So notice I use 70% here for training. And what am I training? So the train model is a generic module that you can use to train different predictive algorithms in Azure ML. Here, I have three branches because I want to test three different algorithms, right?
Got it.
This is a classification problem. So we have many different classification algorithms in Azure Machine Learning. Mm-hmm. The baseline one is logistic regression. I like logistic regression because it's a good benchmark. If you have a classification problem, logistic regression tends to be the one of the simpler algorithms you can use for modeling.
Okay.
And if it works, it's extremely transparent. You will see the formula. You can explain the model very well.
Right.
But typically, it doesn't perform as well as some of the more sophisticated algorithms, like boosted decision trees,
right,
or random forest, for instance, or neural networks. Mm-hmm. Okay. So on the left branch, I'm training a model with a two-class boosted decision tree algorithm, right? This ships out of the box. This is a boosted decision tree from Azure Machine Learning. And when I click on it, you see it shows me all the parameters. The first thing you choose is, do you want a single parameter or do you want to try different parameters in a range? It's always better to try a range because if you use a single parameter, it's hard to know what's the optimal value for each
parameter. And when you say parameters, for those that are listening that may not know, are you talking about parameters for the model itself, or are you talking about the actual data that's coming in?
Oh, good question, Seth. It's parameters for the learning algorithm.
Because these are all parameterized models.
Yes.
Got it.
So in this case, these are all parameters that we will use to train the two-class boosted decision tree algorithm. Mm-hmm. If we just look at a few of them, the first one is, hey, what's the maximum number of leaves per tree? So you're telling it, because the boosted decision tree builds many different decision trees mm-hmm. in an ensemble model, and it uses them as a panel, right?
Like a linear combination of small trees.
Yes.
Got it.
So you have to tell it many different aspects about the algorithm. For example, you tell it what's the maximum number of leaves in each of those trees. Why is that important? It tells the algorithm how big it can grow the trees, right? Without that, you know, it could just grow very simple trees, which are not very very powerful.
Or very complex, which are overfit.
Which will overfit, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So you control it. Another thing you do is you tell it, how many trees do you want, right? And that's number of points. So minimum number of samples, that's another one, sorry. Minimum number of samples per leaf node. It gets at the, it's another way to get at the same thing, complexity of the tree.
I love this tension in these models. I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah. There's this tension between a simpler model and a more complex model.
Yes.
A simpler model won't discriminate very well. A complex model will overfit, and you sort of have to find some like magic middle ground, right?
Yes. No, that's it. It's a pretty foundational tension in machine learning, right? The tension between bias and variance. You can't optimize only for one, right? A very simple model will have very high bias, but it's weak.
Yeah.
It won't predict very well. Like the simplest model could be just an average, right?
Yeah.
Or one value for everyone. Like in this case, a naive model could say, you know, you could say, oh, everyone will pass, right? All of these batches will pass. At face value, it will have high accuracy, but it doesn't, when you look at the numbers, it will be a very weak model.
Yeah.
On the other extreme, a very complex model will easily overfit the data,
mm-hmm.
especially with complex algorithms like boosted decision trees. Left to its own devices, it could build 5,000 trees, and each one could be a very deep tree. Now, that's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, of course.
Because what it will do is, it will try to fit every single nuance in the training data. And so what you see is, 100% accuracy on the training set.
Yes.
But when you test it in the wild, it could only have 50% accuracy.
That's why I always say, if I'm getting 100% on these things, there's something wrong. It shouldn't be that good.
Yes, absolutely. If you ever see anything close to 100%, performance, whether it's 100% accuracy or area under the curve from an ML model, you should be worried. There's something wrong with the model.
And if you're getting 50%, you might as well flip a coin, right? Because it's the
same thing. 50% is random.
Yeah.
So a good classification model should be better than 50%.
Of course.
But less than 100%.
All right, so let's keep going.
Yeah, and that's a healthy tension between simplicity and complexity,
right?
Okay, so let's keep going. So this model does the training, this model does the scoring.
Okay.
So after we run it, you see this model will provide what's in the output. It's a learned object, it's a trained model, right? I can use that model now to score any sensor readings, right? And it'll tell me pass or fail, right? Then we score it with this module here. And that's why we pass the trained model over. And the second input is the test data, right? Which I got from this splitter here. That's the 30%
that you left
sample
for
that
testing.
I held out, right? And then the last thing we have here, Seth, is this module called evaluate model. And very simply, what it does is it'll evaluate the performance of your algorithm on the test set to see, okay, is it any good or not?
Can we look at that? Because there's a couple of things that I wanted to make sure are clear. So if you right-click on the one
I've run this experiment. So when you copy this over to your workspace, you will run it. At the end, you'll get the numbers. So if you just click on the output, do visualize.
So there's a couple of questions I have. There's a couple of questions I have.
Yes.
I know that there's two models that are being evaluated side by side. One is the boosted decision tree and the other is logistic regression.
Correct.
So I always get confused. Which one is the blue one and which one is the red one?
Yes, I get confused sometimes too. But one of the things I remember is blue line is usually from the left branch.
Got it.
And red is from the right branch, if you ever get confused.
So that's the first thing. And this is this the ROC curve?
Yes.
What does this mean?
Receiver operating curve. It's critical to a classifier. Basically, it's one of the instruments you use to assess the performance of your model.
Got it.
You know, you said earlier that if the model only performs 50%, then it's no good. It's only as good as a
random flip
of the coin. You will see that here. On this curve, if your model is no good, say if you're just guessing 50-50, your answers will be on the diagonal line, right?
Okay.
So if your model is anywhere close to the diagonal line, reset, go start again.
Yeah.
Basically, what the ROC curve shows, ROC is receiver operating curve, what it shows is how well does my model discriminate the two classes. If it's perfect, then your curve should go up from 0, 0. It should go up on the y-axis, up to 1.
And then over.
And then left all the way to the top right-hand side.
Okay.
Because that perfect model perfectly discriminates the failures from the passes and the yield.
Okay.
But as I said, that's not a good model either. If your model actually did that, right, showed 100%
spidey area sense under of the wrongness curve, should come up.
Then yes, it's a good sign that it's overfitting.
Yeah.
So visually you can see the performance of your curve here, or your performance of your model from this curve, you know. But it's always better to check this number, which is the area under the curve, AUC.
Mm-hmm.
A perfect model will have an AUC of 100%, so 1.
Right.
And a really poor model will have AUC of 50%, because that's the area under the ROC curve.
So I see.
This diagonal line here has an area, if you do the integration, right,
mm-hmm.
the area is 0.5.
Okay.
But the perfect model will have an area of 1. That's
Got
why.
It.
So between the two, you see that the blue one has an area under the curve of 0.76. The red one has a slightly lower value, which is 0.749. Mm-hmm. The red one in this case is coming from the middle branch, which is which uses logistic regression
okay.
for training. The blue one comes from
booster decision tree.
So typically, in fact, this one, in most cases, booster decision tree clearly outperforms logistic regression.
So what's a good AUC value that you could be like, okay, I'm pretty confident this is going to be okay?
Yeah, it depends on the problem and the data set you're looking at.
Okay.
But typically, a good one should be between 70 and 90 or 95%.
Got it.
Yes. In cases where the target class you're looking for is very, very distinct in terms of their behaviors, then you're more likely to see higher values for area under the curve. But less so where it's harder to discriminate the good guys from the bad.
So then the last question on this is this notion of a threshold.
Yes.
Because the model is outputting something,
yes.
But then you're telling it something with a threshold. Will you explain that for us?
Yes, that's a great question, Seth. So when you build any predictive model, you should look for more than just accuracy, right? Typically, people say, when people ask, you know, how good is your model? They say, it's very good. It's 90% accurate. That doesn't tell you a lot. You should look for other indicators of performance, such as the area under the curve, precision, recall, F-score, and that's why we have that in the confusion matrix here.
Yeah, which is right there, yeah.
Okay, so to answer your question about threshold, what does the threshold mean and how should you set it? The threshold is the point, so here you see by default, Azure ML sets your threshold at 0.5.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go back to what the model does. What does it actually do? It doesn't tell you, you know, this particular reading is a pass or fail. It doesn't tell you that as a 1 or 0. Instead, it gives you a score. And that score is actually a conditional probability that given the input readings from these sensors, we believe the probability of failure is maybe 0.5. For another batch, the probability could be, say, 0.1, in which case you can infer that it's
not gonna fail.
It's a pass. If the probability, so in this case, because the threshold is set at 0.5, anything less than 0.5 will be labeled 0.
Mm-hmm.
Anything above, any score above 0.5 will be labeled 1.
I see.
So that's the threshold, is the threshold that we will use now after modeling to label each record.
And this is interesting, because let's just say we're doing predictive maintenance on a human and we're trying to predict whether they have cancer.
Yes.
You want to move that threshold much lower, because
yes.
if they have a 50% chance, you for sure want them to get it checked out further.
Yes.
And so you would lower the threshold to
yes.
like 0.3 or something more relevant.
And you can see, so if we slide it, and I'm glad you're asking these questions, right? So by default, we were at
0.5,
so about there. You see that precision is 0.5, but recall is pretty low, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and that's because you see, if you watch the number of false positives versus false negatives, it'll change as I change my my threshold,
mm-hmm.
right? As I reduce the threshold, notice that the recall slide starts to increase, but precision
starts to go down,
starts to decrease. So that threshold, because the threshold is what I use to label each batch as 1 or 0, once you label them, then you can measure, what's the rate of false positives? What's the rate of false negatives, or true positives
right.
and true negatives,
mm-hmm.
right? And as you slide the threshold, it actually impacts your precision and recall.
Right.
But it's a very important question. Where do you set the threshold? What's the optimal threshold for this application? All right, again, it depends on what you're optimizing for,
right?
If it's a medical application, for instance, where the cost of false negative is very, very high, right?
Like death, for example.
Yes, because in that case, let's say, if we're using this to predict who will have cancer or not, a false positive means we say, Val will likely have cancer, and it turns out it was wrong. Okay, no big deal, right?
Yeah.
When we do the biopsies, we'll find out. So that cost is not as high. But the cost of a false negative is critical.
Yeah.
Because what that means is we say, Val will not have cancer. He's good, right? And then down the line, I actually develop cancer.
Right.
So that false negative could be a life or death situation. Mm-hmm. So for that application, the hospital or the cancer center could say, you know what, let's optimize for recall. I don't care so much about precision, because we can deal with it.
Got it.
We will do biopsies afterwards. We don't just rush you and do a mastectomy or something. Mm-hmm. So in that application, you can relax your threshold to increase the recall rate. Because what that does is it makes sure that you catch all the cases you're interested in.
Where the false negatives won't come up as much.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So there are many ways to optimize that threshold. Some people just set it in a way that will make the model the most accurate. But in more critical situations, whether it's critical business situations or medical applications, you can apply a cost, because there are costs associated with false positive and false negative.
Right.
We know the cost, the benefit of a true positive or the cost of a false negative. If we enter the values of all of those benefits and costs in the confusion matrix, we can optimize we can find the threshold, the probability threshold that optimizes our cost.
Got it. Mm-hmm. So now that you've done this and you have several models and you can compare them, you pick one model. What if I want to operationalize this? I want to use this in my software. How do I go about using the goodness that you've learned inside of my own software?
Yes, that's a great question, because this, to me, is one of the biggest benefits of Azure Machine Learning.
Right.
Historically, it's been very, very hard to deploy ML models in production, right? It's hard enough building these models. It's fun. But once you're done, to deploy it, you have to do extra work And exactly how you deploy depends on your environment, right? But in many cases, you'll have to write extra code to deploy it in production.
Well, not only that, but your data scientist may have written something in R, and the other one wrote it in Python because they like Python, and the other one used MATLAB because they love MATLAB, and then you're like, how do we make this work? Because our code is in C#, what do we do?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's typical. Mm-hmm. In fact, I know of more extreme cases where the production environment only ran COBOL code on mainframes, right? That's how all their business apps, the scoring apps, were actually deployed.
Holy cow.
And so in the past, when statisticians built regression models, they would share the formula with detailed descriptions to the production team, who will then go and code it in COBOL. To run it on mainframe.
And it seems like a waste of like brain cycles, right? Like to write it once and then write it again.
It's a lot of wasted effort, wasted time, and also it can also impact performance.
Of course.
Because important information can be lost in translation. Correct. Imagine going from R code or Python to C#, right? You can lose vital information about the model along the way.
Or precision might be different in the different programming languages. You're using a double and a float, and then you're like really hosed.
Yes, we have to be. In that case, you have to be extra diligent to revalidate the model after it's deployed in production, because you have to be 100% sure that the model that's deployed is the same as what you built, right?
Right.
As your ML solves all of that.
All right, let's see how it's
because
done.
You can deploy your model in only a few steps. So now that I'm done, you know, I ran this model earlier. If you go up, all you do is, all right, what do you want to do? Do you want to retrain the web service? No, I don't, because I haven't deployed one. So let's start with the first option, predictive web service. So if I click on that, it says, oh, you know, tell me which of these algorithms to deploy, because I have three, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So I want the boosted decision tree, because that was the most powerful of the three. So we go in there. If you do that, now you see it's running. And oh, this is a part I really like. You see what it's doing, Seth? Let me close these guys. So in real time, it's reconfiguring my experiment, right? It's rewiring it to prepare for deployment.
Holy cow, mm-hmm. I didn't do that. Last time I saw this, mm-hmm. I literally had to save a trained model and
yes.
build a whole new thing. This
yes.
is actually creating the thing for me now.
It's like magic. So we've talked about the old process, right? Before Azure Machine Learning. I mean, that's clearly a no-no. With Azure Machine Learning, this is cool. This is so cool, I'm telling you. The first thing they did is
let's show the screen, because it went literally from this big tree
complex mess,
and it transformed into this. Yeah.
Yep. So in the first wave, Azure Machine Learning simplified it through a wizard, but you had to do a couple of steps, right? Maybe up to six different steps to deploy.
Uh-huh.
But now they've automated all of that, and it's just cool. That's what it was doing.
That's
basically
amazing.
So it'll save your model. It will get rid of all the redundant nodes. You see, it's dropped all of those other nodes. I had a bunch of nodes. I had like 25 to 30 nodes there.
Let's pause there, because I want to make sure that people understand what happened. When you wanted to deploy the model, it said pick the one that you want.
Yes.
You picked it and then ran it again. And then it just put everything together into the web service that you have.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And what it's doing is, it was basically eliminating all the other nodes I didn't need. Because for starters, I had not one, but three different training algorithms, right? I only need one. So it got rid of the other two, the logistic regression. And mm-hmm. the one I didn't show you was, it used Bayesian learning.
Got
right?
it.
And then everything in between. So it cuts it down to the bare minimum you need. So we have the web input and the web service output.
That's amazing. And my main complaint was that it did not do this before. I literally had to save a trained model. I had to make a whole new experiment, and then I had to run it again. This is beautiful.
Our customer spoke, and we listen.
Fantastic.
Right? So it's much, much, much simpler now. So once you do that, see, it's now ready, it's created. That's my training experiment. My old training experiment is still there. But now, it's just warming up. You see, that's the old training experiment, right? In all its glory. But now, it's after reconfiguring, it's created a new predictive experiment for web deployment.
This is so much better than what
this
it was
is
before,
a web. Yeah, this is
a,
the web service is created. So if we do that, let's run. We run this guy, and when it's once it's done, we'll go ahead and just deploy. So it's still running. Let it run.
So as it's running, because I want to, because we got to let these things bake a little bit. Mm-hmm. How do I know how to use this? Is like, is there code that somewhere that shows like examples of how to use this?
Great question.
Okay.
Because we've simplified it so much for you. So now it's done running. Now, so the final step is to deploy. Let's deploy this model as a web service, right? So in three steps, you can now deploy your model in production.
So you operationalized,
first,
yeah.
Yes, so first, I ran the experiment. No, it's just four steps. I ran the experiment. Mm-hmm. Then I went in and said, prepare this experiment mm-hmm. for deployment. That's when it automated everything and simplified. Mm-hmm. You ran it again, and then you said, go ahead and deploy.
That's
Look,
awesome.
In under 5 minutes, we've deployed this model in production.
So is there a website I can go to look at how to use this code?
Absolutely. So here, it gives you a number of things. Number one, I want to point out, it deploys two options, right? You can call the model, the web service, as a response, request response mode, or you can call it in batch. What's the difference? In the first option, if you call it through request response, it's like the way a web service normally runs mm-hmm. today, right? I come in, if I want to score a given record, I call the API with the input variables, and it says, here's the output, right? And you can do that dialogue over and over again. But if you want to score, say, 1 million rows, that's not efficient, right? You can't do that
a
million
times. Yeah, it's a lot of
calls. Yes. So that's why we have the second option, batch execution, mm-hmm. right? If you want to score 1 million rows all at once, you use the batch execution, you do it in one shot, it comes back with 1 million scores, right?
That's awesome.
That's the first thing. Number two, and I'll answer your question in a minute. Number two is another thing that's very unique with Azure ML is Excel. When you deploy in production, they give you sample Excel workbooks from which you can call the same API. So if you're a business analyst and you don't want to go and mess around with R code or Python code, just use Excel. And in Excel, you call it with the inputs and say, what's the answer?
So you literally just like type in a bunch of examples and then you just hook it up and it's going to fill in the column with the right
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
No one else does this.
Yeah.
So I want to make sure I answer your question. Number one, you ask, where do I find this thing? We've deployed it now, right? Mm-hmm. So if I do test, it'll show you details of the experiment which is deployed. Now it's loading data.
So the thing I find impressive about this is that we were able to go through this whole, like we talked a lot just to make sure we understood, but in reality, like you really didn't do that much.
Nope.
Because we had the template, we ran the experiment, we set up the predictive web service, and now we're actually running it.
Yep. So here I'm actually testing it for real. You can go in and test it, right? Here's all my sensor data. In this case, it has all 500 and 91, even though we only need 60, mm-hmm. right?
But you're still going to get that data because that's the data
part
it came
in. Yeah. Yes, that's just part of the schema. Then you can go ahead and actually test it. You'll get the output. The other one, since we don't have too much time, if we go back, hold on, go back to dashboard, you can actually see, you can see details. Once it's deployed, you can see details of this web service.
Mm-hmm.
If you deployed it and people are starting to use it, you'll actually, over time, you'll see the number of requests you're having, whether it's batch requests or request response. You see the details like average request response compute time. You see your costs and all that, right?
Here's the amazing thing. Like, I'm looking at how we're literally selling them. This is how much it costs. Mm-hmm. So you will make 1,000 calls to this API for 50 cents. And if in one of those 1,000, your ATM machine came up mm-hmm. and someone came and serviced it before you had that disgusting experience, it would have saved it for 50 cents.
Yep.
That's impressive.
That's the power of Azure Machine Learning.
That's impressive, yeah.
You know, and see how easily we deployed the model. Okay. Then you can go, so it shows you many different aspects of the model. Let me go back here.
All right, so but how do you write the code for this?
Sure. So Seth, if we go here, click default, then it gives you a number of options and even has new tutorials now mm-hmm. to guide you through you know, how to use this web service, how to retrain, etc. But notice there's this option here, use endpoint.
Okay.
If you click on that, it gives you a number of things. Number one, you still see your Excel workbook,
which we talked about earlier.
Yes. But second, it shows you, see, look, it tells you these are the keys you'll use to call the API, right? Because it's a secure endpoint,
sure.
right? No one can use, you can't call that API without these keys.
Got it.
Okay. Then,
this
how
is what
do
I was
you actually
for,
call
yeah.
it? You know, Azure ML gives you not one, but 4 different options to call this web service. If you write, if you're writing a C# application, you use this option, right?
Hold
copy and paste.
Can we scroll down? Because it's actually using the code for your example, not just boilerplate, then you put your stuff here. This is your stuff.
This is mine. Look, the input names are mine,
wow,
right?
That's
sensor
amazing.
Number one all the way to sensor number 591,
mm-hmm.
although we won't use all of them, right? It's just part of the schema, right? But there's... You go in and replace this API key with the one I showed you at the top.
Right.
That's unique to your app, right? So we saw this is a C# one. If you write Python, if you prefer Python, that's a Python code. You just copy and paste.
Yeah.
Right. And it uses the URL, lib2, and JSON.
Of course.
If you prefer Python 3.0 or above. You use this one instead, and because you see, you'll use a different version of the URL lib. And if you prefer R, just use this one, which uses the R curl and R JSON packages.
So this is amazing, and I feel like we've gone long, but I love that we did. I like that we started with machine learning's hard. Mm. Why don't we give you something to start with, but give you something that's very explanatory? You went through like what the question was. You went through what our data was, you set up the model through the template, you trained the model, then you deployed the model, and then you showed us how to actually use it. Any last words about this?
You know, the biggest value in Azure Machine Learning is ease of deployment.
Right.
Right, because as we discussed earlier, that's a non-trivial problem today when you write your own, if you build your own machine learning models in R or Python or some other language. But the other thing I really like about Azure Machine Learning is the way it integrates models you build in R and also Python, which means it's really a one-stop shop, right? It's a workbench you can use to build models from scratch. And you can also bring in your own models you built in R or Python, and it just works. So when you put all of this together, you can actually deploy a model that has algorithms from Azure Machine Learning together with your own that you brought from R or Python and just deploy it together in the same web service. That's truly powerful.
This is amazing, right? Because you people have invested so much in sort of their R models or their Python models. Yeah. You're saying there's modules in there that lets you just put that code in there and it'll just work.
Yes.
That's amazing. Well, Val, this has been so informational. Thanks so much for spending some time with
us. Thank you very much, Seth. It was a pleasure.
We'll put some links below so you can see where this particular template is, so you too can also run it. Thanks so much for watching. Thanks so much, Val, again. My name is Seth Juarez. This is TenAlign, and we've been learning all about Azure Machine Learning, particularly templates in the gallery. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Seth.